Support for IPR comes from Orchestra Iowa, presenting the movie E.T., the extraterrestrial on the big screen, accompanied by the Symphony Orchestra performing the score live, May 3rd and 4th at 7:30 at the Paramount. Tickets at orchestraiowa.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Later on the show, I'll talk with Dr. Greg Cohen. He's a family physician in Lucas County, and although his patients still trust his expertise with most of what ails them, he finds that many don't believe the information he gives them about COVID-19. We will explore that lack of trust. But first, Nalini Nadkarni is known as the Queen of the Forest Canopy. She is a pioneer in the exploration of canopy ecosystems in the rainforest in Costa Rica and in the Pacific Northwest. In addition to advancing our scientific understanding of forest ecology, she's also an innovator when it comes to getting humans whose feet are firmly planted on the ground to connect with and care about the forests that we all depend on. These days, she is a professor of biology at the University of Utah, and she'll be giving the annual Paul L. Arrington Memorial Lecture at Iowa State University this year. She'll be speaking Thursday, September 16th at 7 p.m. This is a virtual event, so you can be in the audience wherever you are. The title of her lecture is A Question of Values, Weaving Science and Society for Forest Conservation. Nalini Nadkarni, thank you so much for being here.
You bet. It's a pleasure to do this.
And you have spoken many times about falling in love with trees as a child. Take us back there. Tell us about how you made that connection.
Sure. I had sort of a mixed background in terms of my parents. My dad was from India, a Hindu, a scientist. He worked for the NIH. And my mom is of Russian parentage, and she grew up in Brooklyn, New York. She was raised as an Orthodox Jew. So my four siblings and I had kind of a mixed up cultural and religious background. And, you know, we had dogs and cats and homework and so forth. And I found that, you know, for me, I found my refuge and my place of safety and place of joy up in the trees. My parents' driveway had 8 maple trees that lined the driveway, and every day after school I would jump up one of them, and just it was kind of my world, my refuge. And I really felt like, gosh, you know, when I turn out to be a grown-up, I really want to do something that will help trees, that will help them, protect them, and make them safer, because they had been so important to me in terms of providing me with safety and refuge and fun. And I really didn't know how I would do that. I thought, well, maybe I'll be a forest fighter, you know, a firefighter or a park ranger. But when I got to college, I discovered myself the world of ecology, the study of plants and animals and their relationship to the environment. And I realized, wow, you know, this is a way that I could make a living by understanding trees and perhaps be able to protect them more as well.
Well, and when you arrived at that, you arrived in a moment where we were beginning to understand how threatened the rainforest, especially the Amazon rainforest, was. But we also were beginning to understand that we didn't know very much about it. Tell me how you got involved in studying the forest canopy in Costa Rica.
Sure. Well, you know, every scientist, especially young emerging scientists like graduate students, are always supposed to be exploring the unknown and making new discoveries. And really, I think, you know, any biologist, especially any forest ecologist who was beginning to do research at that time in the late 1980s, was becoming more and more aware of the issues around deforestation, forest fragmentation, especially in tropical rainforests. And so I took a field course my first summer of graduate school and went down to Costa Rica, where there are a number of really wonderful field stations. And I remember looking up into the canopy of the Monteverde cloud forest and going like, oh my gosh, look at all these plants that are living up there, the orchids and bromeliads and ferns, and look at the monkeys and the birds. And there's so much going on, you know, just above our heads. And as it turned out, really people, scientists, biologists, didn't know much about the forest canopy because they simply didn't have access to it. And it was right at that time that there were a few forest canopy people just beginning to kind of break through into the frontier, what was called the last biotic frontier on Earth, and applying mountain climbing techniques and hot air balloons and construction cranes to get up into the forest canopy safely and non-destructively. And I was one of those early pioneers and was really fortunate to sort of get in on the ground floor, or the top floor, I guess, in the beginning, to be able to explore and observe and carry out experiments to better understand what this unknown part of the forest is and does and how it connects to the rest of the forest landscape.
And we could probably spend many hours talking about that ecosystem that you found when you climbed those trees. But give us, for those of us who aren't familiar with it, just a little bit of understanding of how complex and really miraculous that ecosystem is.
Sure. I mean, I wish I could take you up there, Charity, and all of the listeners up there, because it really is like exploring an unknown world. You know, when you start walking through a forest, you're walking along the forest floor. It's kind of dark and damp, and there's no wind because of all the overhanging leaves and branches. But once you start moving vertically up into the forest canopy, putting on your harness, climbing up the rope to get up into the tops of the trees, you notice immediately that the microenvironment is very, very different in the canopy than on the forest floor. There are much greater extremes of relative humidity. There's a lot more sunlight. There's a lot more wind. It's almost like the atmosphere of an open field, much more exposed. And the architecture of where these plants and animals have to sort of navigate and negotiate is very different from the forest floor. You know, basically branches are these sort of cylinders suspended in three-dimensional space. And so it's a different microenvironment, it's a different architecture, and for that reason, there are these literally thousands of plants and animals that have adapted themselves over evolutionary time to the microenvironment and the architecture of the forest canopy. Plants and animals you simply never see on the forest floor. And so in terms of diversity, there's this huge diversity of plants and animals up there, and there are also really interesting and very important processes of pollination, of fruit dispersal, of fungal interactions, of root interactions that are going on high above the forest floor. So you can imagine, you know, once you first get up there, you think, oh my gosh, I could spend my entire life in this one tree just studying what's going on, what's happening in the forest canopy, and how it might relate to the forest as a whole.
When you really began to understand the canopy, that also led you to an understanding of what we lose when we cut down these first growth forests. And of course, we know that old growth forests have been cut down all over the planet in just numbers that we really can't even comprehend, although humans have done it. But help me understand what we lose when these forests start to disappear.
Sure. Well, one of the things that my students and my colleagues and I have demonstrated is that although these canopy-dwelling plants, the so-called epiphytes, epi means upon and phyte meaning plant, the plants that live up in the forest canopy do not have roots that go into the tree or into the forest floor, but rather they get their nutrients and their water from what we call atmospheric sources, from mist and rain and cloud that blanket these tropical forests. And so every little droplet of water, every little droplet of mist actually contains a tiny bit of nitrogen and phosphorus and magnesium and the nutrients that are responsible for keeping these plants alive. And these plants have developed and evolved a number of mechanisms to be very efficient at holding on to these nutrients and water that come in through rain and fog. And so when we cut these forests down or alter them or isolate particular trees, because farmers cut down trees around them to make pastures, we're really losing the capacity of the forest as a whole to intercept and retain these critical nutrients that help maintain the forest as a whole. And in addition, we've also looked at how the flowers and the fruits and the mosses that grow up in the forest canopy provide resources, sugars and nutrients for arboreal mammals and birds. So when we cut the forest down and when we remove the forest canopy, we're really kind of blocking the ability of that forest to both increase the nutrient capital of the forest as a whole, as well as providing critical nutrients and water for the plants and animals that live up there.
You have also studied the canopy in the forests in the Pacific Northwest. I think for a lot of people, tropical rainforests are fascinating, but very far away. And rainforests are here in the United States, right?
Absolutely. We actually, in Washington State, in the Olympic National Park, where I've done much of my research in the United States, probably has, you know, just about the most fantastic and most wonderful representation of what we call temperate rainforests. Rainforests that get more than 90 inches of rain a year. And just like their tropical counterparts, The canopies of these trees support an enormous diversity of mosses, of liverworts, and of lichens that very similarly participate in nutrient cycling and the provision of resources for canopy-dwelling animals. So we do have temperate rainforests right here in our own backyard, as well as in other parts of the temperate zones around the world, in Chile, in New Zealand, and in other places where there's a considerable amount of rain along coastal regions.
So help me make the connection between these just incredible old growth forests and the kinds of forests that most of us do encounter, because we know that most of the United States has been clear cut at one time or another. So the forests that we encounter are not the same.
Right. And that's, you know, that's a puzzle that forest ecologists are trying to understand desperately, as you point out, more and more of our world's forests are being affected or have been affected by human activities, not just deforestation, but also forest fragmentation, climate change, invasive species, and so forth. I mean, we think of forests as being kind of immovable, and in some of these old growth forests as what we call the ancient forests of the Pacific Northwest. But trees and forests really do have a remarkable capacity to regenerate, if not with the complement of exact species of the primary forests or the old growth forests, they still can grow back and carry out many of the functions that they did before. But there's really nothing that can replace the long-term cooking, so to speak, of evolution, of interactions that occurs and continues to occur in these last remnant old growth and ancient forests that occupy the tropical and temperate parts of our globe.
Help me understand just how rare those old growth forests are on our planet.
Well, I don't know the exact percentages, but in the Pacific Northwest, really very, very little old growth forest remains outside of national parks and private protected landscapes. So we really have probably less than 5% of the original old growth forest that used to occupy these huge areas of the Pacific Northwest. And with that, of course, comes the diminution of the animals that are dependent on old growth forests, like the northern spotted owl, many species of insects, many species of invertebrates that now simply have a much more shrunken, so to speak, capacity to live because of the disappearance of these old growth forests.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with Nalini Nadkarni. She is known as the Queen of the Forest Canopy. She is a biologist at the University of Utah. This is Talk of Iowa.
Support for IPR comes from Orchestra Iowa, presenting the movie E.T., the extraterrestrial on the big screen, accompanied by the Symphony Orchestra performing the score live, May 3rd and 4th at 7:30 at the Paramount. Tickets at orchestraiowa.com.
Can we heal the environment? In Kansas, we're working on it. Up From Dust is a podcast about how humans reshaped the world to fit urban landscapes and agricultural needs. We'll meet the people who are rolling up their sleeves to find more sustainable ways forward. Listen to Up From Dust from KCUR, part of the NPR network.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Coming up in just about 15 minutes, I'll talk with Dr. Greg Cohen. He is a family physician in Lucas County, Iowa. And throughout this pandemic, he has found that although his patients continue to trust him to treat their blood pressure, diabetes, and other ailments, many of his patients do not trust what he tells them about COVID-19. We'll talk about this lack of trust in a few minutes. With me right now is Nalini Nadkarni. She is known as the Queen of the Forest Canopy. She is a pioneer in the exploration of canopy ecosystems in Costa Rica and in the Pacific Northwest. She is a professor of biology at the University of Utah, and she'll be giving the annual Paul L. Arrington Memorial Lecture at Iowa State University this year. She'll be speaking Thursday evening at 7 p.m. It is a virtual event, so you can be there wherever you are. And Nalini Nadkarni, we've talked a lot about your pioneering research into the forest canopy. You also have done an incredible amount of work to try to bring the information that you have gleaned, but also your connection with forests and forest ecology to members of the public who maybe don't have a scientific background, who can't have these kinds of experiences. Did you have a moment in your career where you realized that communicating about what you were learning was maybe as important as what you were learning in and of itself?
Yes, actually, you know, it's funny. I have a sort of a very extroverted personality in any case. And I know that there's nothing that makes me happier than when I can share some fact or figure or image or an understanding of the forest with other people. But there was a moment when I began realizing that I think that I need to do more than just write my little scientific papers that other scientists read or go to conferences where other scientists will hear me talk about what I've learned about the forest canopy. And that was when I was up in a tall tree, up in a strangler fig in the Monteverde Cloud Forest Reserve, where I've done most of my research. And I was in the reserve in a tree, and I heard the sound of a chainsaw just outside of the border of this reserve. And it was at that moment that something sort of clicked in me, and I realized I really do need to do something more than just do what a typical scientist does. And I knew that I did not like really talking to policymakers. I find it very hard to give them that yes or no, black and white kind of answer that they often seek. But I thought that one of the things I could do would be to share and raise awareness of the importance of trees to human beings in general, especially amongst people who might not have the opportunity to visit a rainforest themselves. And I began working with National Geographic to make films and to, you know, write for their magazine and other natural history magazines, give talks at museums and so forth. But I pretty soon realized that, you know, the people who were watching this National Geographic documentary or listening to a talk in a museum were probably people who already know the importance of trees. And that's when I began thinking about other ways to get access to other groups, other public groups that might not be able to get access or don't take access to these traditional ways of getting information about nature and about science. And so that's when I began thinking about, well, how do I get to little girls who maybe don't have access to climb trees the way I did when I was a little girl? And my students and I began brainstorming with, well, why not Barbie? Like, every little girl loves Barbie. So we began making these treetop Barbies. We went to volunteer seamstresses and had them made the little outfits. We got little helmets on eBay. We made a little pamphlet that describes canopy-dwelling plants and why Barbie is interested in them. We actually approached Mattel about it, and this was about 15 years ago, and they were, for some reason, not interested in starting a treetop Barbie line, nor a ground support Ken line, as we also suggested. So we just did it ourselves. We bought Barbies from used, you know, from Goodwill stores. We dressed her up, and we sold them on my little tiny academic website. But what was really interesting was, like, 15 years later, just 2 years ago, I was contacted by Mattel and the National Geographic, and they decided to start a new line of Explorer Barbies. Like a wildlife photographer Barbie and an astrophysicist Barbie. And they asked me to be an advisor on the project because I had already approached them and had sort of started this little cottage industry with treetop Barbie. And so now these Explorer Barbies exist out there. You can buy them from Amazon and from different websites. And I think it's really kind of a lesson that even though, you know, when you first start out with a new and innovative idea, it may not go very far, but I think if you're persistent and if the need is there, then even a corporation like Mattel, you know, sort of comes through. And so I've been really excited about the fact that we now have these dolls that can inspire young girls wherever they might be growing up to think about trees and think about nature and think about science as a pathway for themselves, either as a career or just to appreciate it. And I think that's a really wonderful story in terms of how a scientist can go about making a small difference, but a difference nonetheless that goes beyond the doors and the walls of academia.
And there is a beautiful treetop Barbie that looks very much like you that is now, I'm sure, in the hands of many children and many adults as well. When you think about those trees that you used to climb and the time that you spent in nature and falling in love with nature, I mean, we do know that we won't protect what we don't love. Do you worry that kids aren't making that connection in the society that we've built with, you know, so many things that, that keep them indoors or on the couch or disconnected from the natural world because of their socioeconomic circumstances or whatever it is. We've got so many barriers to that now.
That's correct. And that is something that I and many, many other scientists and ecologists do worry about. I think many of us now, many scientists are beginning to both understand and be given permission to spend more of our time, not just writing scientific papers for other scientists, which of course is extremely important, and I feel honored to be part of the making of the scientific record, but also now, you know, the National Science Foundation, for example, now requires scientists in every proposal that we write to outline what is called broader impacts. That is, not only what is the research going to find out about making new discoveries about the tops of trees, but how does that relate in a broader way to the benefits of society? So that might be public engagement activities. It might be thinking about homeland security. It might be doing training for people, undergraduate students. So I think the world of science is actually shifting, albeit slowly, but is shifting more in a way that scientists can feel supported and appreciated for taking time to carry out these broader impacts, to understand and to communicate the importance of what they're doing with research to the general public. And I really find that is such an exciting development in the scientific enterprise.
Now, you are really an extraordinary communicator. I know a lot of scientists, and some of them are amazing communicators, and some of them clearly went into a scientific field so they wouldn't have had to talk to anybody ever again. I mean, does that feel like kind of an unfair burden?
I've met a few of those colleagues down my hallway. And, you know, I don't know whether it's because, you know, they have an introverted personality to begin with, or whether, you know, historically for a very long time, the ivory tower really has been the ivory tower. Mm. It's been a place where people can carry out their research, their scientific research, in the absence of having to have responsibilities for public engagement or for teaching sixth graders or whatever. But I think the ivory tower now is developing some windows, windows where information not only goes out, but information that comes in from public groups. Like, for example, I know that, you know, from my work in the Pacific Northwest, that although loggers, you know, people who cut down trees for a living, very often are vilified by ecologists, actually, the loggers that I know, all of them love trees, they respect them, they have a deep understanding of their structure and their function. And one of the reasons that they participate in the logging industry is to be close to trees. And so I think that if we can set up pathways of communication between loggers and forest ecologists, or between artists who look at the aesthetic values of trees and forests and scientists, we can make more headway in terms of highlighting the many, many values that trees and forests and nature in general have for people on our earth.
I'm talking with Nalini Nadkarni. She'll be giving the annual Paul L. Arrington Memorial Lecture at Iowa State University Thursday evening at 7 p.m. It is a virtual event, so you can tune in from wherever you are. And, you know, a lot of people love to be in nature, can appreciate the beauty of a tree or wildflowers or something like that, but they may not have any real knowledge about what they're seeing, what they love. Do you feel like that scientific understanding of the natural world is an important step for people to take to caring enough about the natural world to try to protect it?
Sure. I definitely think that's true. And I think what you said earlier, Charity, about people will take care of and protect what they love. I mean, I remember just this weekend I was watching a neighbor, you know, wax and polish his sports car and going like, wow, he is really spending a lot of time taking care of that sports car, something which I don't particularly feel is valuable, but he clearly does, and he is taking care of it. And it made me think about how I love trees and forest ecologists love trees, and how if we can highlight the values of trees, then people will hopefully take better care of their forest, just as that guy was taking care of his sports car. And I would imagine that the more that this neighbor of mine understands the mechanics of his sports car and how fast it goes and which is the right wax to preserve the paint and so forth, the better he'll be able to protect it. And so in sort of an analogous way, I think that if we scientists, we forest ecologists can communicate the complexity and the diversity and the fragility of these amazing ecosystems, these forest ecosystems, will provide a richer way for people to understand and then be motivated to protect and care for forests.
I mentioned earlier that for a lot of people, the tropical rainforests seem very far away. And we know that we're really at a tipping point as a species, as a planet, when we look at climate change. We also know that more and more people are experiencing firsthand the detrimental effects of climate change every day. Do you feel like we are at a tipping point with people maybe starting to actually care instead of thinking about climate change as something that, that either they don't believe in or just affects other people?
Well, you know, I think this summer has been just a really great example of climate change coming home, literally. You know, scientists have known about climate change and have made predictions based on their global change models and so forth for over 50 years. But I think now that we're seeing more hurricanes that have a much greater capacity to destroy, we're seeing smoke that just filled, I don't know about you, but here in Utah, just filled the Salt Lake Valley and made it impossible to go outside. These remarkable heat events in the Pacific Northwest, the floods that have been going on in our country and in Europe, I think it is beginning to settle into people's mindset and heartset, perhaps more importantly, that this is not something abstract. This is not something that's just a scientist model. This is really happening now. And if we don't take action, actions that might range from, you know, personal actions for, you know, contributing to conservation groups or shifting the way that we commute to work, all of those possibilities do exist and then can help ameliorate the climate change situation. But I think people are beginning to wake up, or as you said, experience this as a tipping point in terms of understanding and being galvanized to take action.
At the same time, we are experiencing the COVID-19 pandemic, and we're witnessing a lot of people rejecting scientific information, just refusing to believe what is clearly true and has been proven to be true. As you witness that, what goes through your mind?
Well, to me, it means that we scientists have to do a better job of making ourselves appear and are as real people. We're not just scientists who are locked in our labs or our field stations. And so that is really that idea of becoming a more real person, someone that people can trust, someone who's, oh, well, I'm a mother, you're a mother, or I'm a skateboarder, you're a skateboarder. So one of the things that I've been doing in the last 15 or 20 years has been trying to become more of a person to people. And I've been working with faith-based groups, giving sermons about trees and spirituality, the relationship between trees in the Holy Scriptures as they've been described in the Quran and the Old Testament and the Book of Mormon, and standing up as a scientist in a church, in a synagogue, in a temple, and saying, you know, I know trees are important from a scientific standpoint, but I am so interested in wanting to know how religious people, people of faith, feel about trees, that I read your Bible, I read your Quran, I read your Talmud, and this is what I've learned about trees, that they're, for instance, in the Old Testament, there are 328 references to the words tree and forest, and they all relate to really important functions as location descriptors, as decorations of temples, practical use, food, shelter. And so in that way, I, as a scientist, being in the church or the synagogue itself, can be approached as an individual, not just a scientist, but as someone who is deeply interested in what other people think about trees. There's this philosophical term called intellectual humility, putting aside our own way of knowing for the moment in order to better understand and find common ground with people that you may not think would have common ground. And so this is just one example, these efforts to connect with faith-based groups that I think scientists can do in order to have more credibility, more connection in a very genuine way, that we can move forward from this traditional separation between science and church or science and other segments of society.
When you are giving a lecture like the one you'll be giving on Thursday, or when people go online and watch your TED Talks, you are in large part still preaching to the choir, people who have already made that connection and want to learn more. For those people, What do you want them to take away from listening to you? What do you hope each and every one of those scientists or conservationists or you know, people who just love the environment, what do you want them to take away and take action with after they hear your story?
Yeah, that's a great question. I guess what I would love to think that I do when I give my talks or give a TED talk or give a talk like the Paul Arrington, the Arrington lecture, is that it will reinforce their own sort of instincts about how they feel good when they take a walk through a forest, or how they feel great about buying a bouquet of flowers and putting it on their kitchen table, and reinforce that connection. And the other thing I've learned in the many years that I've been doing this is that there's not too much point in directing people what to do. I think it makes more sense to say, if you feel, if you have this connection yourself, you will find many, many ways to take action. And it might be joining or giving money to a conservation group like the Nature Conservancy. It might be working for preservation of a local park. It might be simply appreciation of not throwing a piece of paper on the forest floor or on the ground. So I don't have any sort of specific recipe that's going to make each and every person do the same thing. I think what we want to do is evoke in them that sense of value for trees and forests and nature, and allow them then to come up with the many, many ways that they can participate. And going back to the Arrington lecture, the title of my talk is called A Question of Values. And that is actually the title of an essay that Arrington wrote a while ago. You know, he came to conservation not through Nature Conservancy. He was a trapper and a hunter. And he also had a very, very strong sense of aesthetics of when he was in the forest.
We'll have to find out more Thursday evening. But Nalini Nadkarni, thank you so much for being here. She'll be giving the Paul L. Arrington Memorial Lecture at Iowa State University Thursday evening at 7.
Can we heal the environment? In Kansas, we're working on it. Up From Dust is a podcast about how humans reshaped the world to fit urban landscapes and agricultural needs. We'll meet the people who are rolling up their sleeves to find more sustainable ways forward. Listen to Up From Dust from KCUR, part of the NPR network.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. By now, we've all heard the stories about people who are dangerously ill with COVID-19 who refuse to believe their diagnosis even as they struggle for breath. We've seen the videos of patients in COVID wards sharing their hard-won wisdom, saying that they wished that they had gotten vaccinated and that everyone should. But before these patients got to that dangerous point, they've had many opportunities to get good, reliable information about COVID-19. Instead, they believed the equally available misinformation. Dr. Greg Cohen is a family physician in Lucas County, Iowa. He has found that while his patients still trust him with most of their ailments, many refuse to believe what he tells them about COVID-19. He's written about his frustration in an op-ed published on the website Bleeding Heartland, and he is on the line with me now. Hello, Dr. Cohen.
Good morning, Charity.
Thank you
for having me this morning.
Yeah, thank you so much for being here. And we've talked on this program many times about how the early months of the pandemic were very different in rural Iowa than they were in urban areas and other parts of the country. Tell me a little bit about what you experienced early on in Lucas County.
You know, you're reading the news and you're seeing things on TV, and certainly in the beginning of this, it was very, very scary in New York and some of the bigger cities. But in rural Iowa, you're being told all of a sudden things have to shut down, but you don't see it. We didn't have any cases in Lucas County until May. And once we did, it was very obvious they were very different from anything we'd ever seen before. But by then, we'd been closed down for 2 months, and you have people saying, this isn't real, this isn't serious, it's not going to affect rural Iowa the same because we're not all that concentrated, so this is only going to be a city disease. And I think that really set the stage for what happened afterwards.
Well, tell me what's going on in Lucas County now, fast forwarding over a year later.
Fast forwarding, now we have a situation where a whole lot of people never bought into this. So we have a vaccination rate that's about 42%. It was only 37%, so we've made some progress, but it's only 42%. And we've had a vaccine now for, 8-9 months. We have people getting sick left and right now. We now have multiple cases every single day, even in small town Iowa. And we still have people who come in and say, I don't need a vaccine. I don't need medication. I don't trust this. This happened too fast. Or they buy into some of the conspiracy theories, like it has a chip in it and they're going to track us. And you're watching people get sick. They're frequently looking for some of the buzzword treatments, the remedies that are out there that are not proven and, in fact, frequently are toxic to them. And so they come in sometimes too sick and too late to help them with the things that we actually know that do help. And there are things out there like the antibody cocktails. Those work. Those keep people out of the hospital. But you got to do it in the first 7 days, and they're not coming in then. They're coming in later.
So we had this idea, I think, that, you know, there was that early distrust of the vaccines that was pretty, you know, widely seen. And I remember having conversations about how, you know, family physicians are going to be the key to convincing people to get vaccinated, to help them understand that, because family physicians are people that are trusted by their patients. And that has been your experience in your career, right?
Absolutely. I've been in Lucas County now over 27 years. I have a very busy practice. I've done everything from delivering babies to nursing home to emergency room to the hospital to the office. And so, yes, I have people who are longtime patients for decades at this point. And I speak all day long trying to convince people of what the real truth is, trying to give them the best information possible so they can make good choices. It can be very frustrating, though, because as much as you know what the real numbers are, they don't believe it. They don't want to believe it. They're getting their information from other sources. And even though they trust you with their diabetes and their high blood pressure and even their lives, as soon as this topic comes up, a wall goes up and you're lying to them, or it's a hoax, or we've been lied to, or it's a government conspiracy. And it's very hard to help people who aren't open to that kind of help.
Have you ever encountered anything like that in the past?
No, this is a never in my career kind of thing. This isn't my first pandemic. I was trained in New York during the HIV pandemic. So I understand what it is to have a serious illness out there. And I understand what it is for people to not understand it and to believe all kinds of things about it. But I've never seen where they wouldn't take that information and change how they look at things. This is very different from that. Somehow we allowed this disease to divide us in ways that we've not been divided before, and it has crippled our response.
How common is that among your patients? I'm sure it's not every patient, and I'm not asking you to breach any kind of confidentiality, but can you give me an idea of just how prevalent this mindset is in Lucas County?
You know, I have 42% of our county vaccinated. There have probably been somewhere between a third and a half of the people have gotten COVID at some point or another in the last year, whether they knew it or not, depending on their symptoms. But I still see somewhere between 5 and 10 patients a day who still don't think that this is something serious that they need to worry about, that this is that the vaccine isn't safer than actually getting the disease, who still believe things that are clearly not true. I can remember I've had days in the not too distant past where I've had up to 4 people over the age of 75, all of whom refused the vaccine, all of whom I spoke to at length about the fact that, you know, you have a 30 or 40% chance of dying of this disease, and probably a 60 to 70% chance of ending up in the hospital. And they still believed that it was better not to do something than to do something, even knowing those things, or at least hearing them from me. So it's remarkably common, even in people that we know are high risk in Southern Iowa and in rural America in general.
As a physician, how does that feel to you? Again, this is unprecedented in your career. What is that like to try to convince people that you have a relationship with, people that you care about, to do the right thing for themselves? And of course, for the people around them, but even just to save their own life.
For me, it's just terribly sad and frustrating. I look at these people and I say they've been brainwashed. And I can't help them to save themselves. I can't help them to keep themselves from getting sick in a chronic way that may never go away, even if they do survive. Because we know this disease, it doesn't kill everyone. That's not the kind of disease it is. But it maims a lot of people. 25% of the people who get this disease will still have at least one symptom 6 months from now, and some of them may never go away. And it's hard to make that real for people who've been brainwashed, quite frankly.
You have experienced COVID in your own family, so both as a physician and just as a person, you've had up close and personal experience witnessing how dangerous this virus is.
I've had a couple of my children. I've had one child and one daughter-in-law and one son-in-law who've had COVID. My daughter and son-in-law have both had it twice. They had it very early in the pandemic in March or so. And then again, late last October, they got it a second time. My daughter got long COVID from it. She had headache all the time. She had joint aches. She had problems. She was coughing and couldn't exercise and was short of breath most of the time. And she was 25 and healthy. This was a normal, healthy person. She lost her sense of taste and smell for 3 months. Most of that came back, although for most of a year, she was still smelling things that weren't there and not smelling things that were. Fortunately for her, she is a coffeeholic, and she did get her ability to get to taste and smell coffee back, because that was very important. Interestingly, when she got COVID the second time, her symptoms all got worse. And she was going to specialists because specialists didn't want to believe that she had that long COVID was even a syndrome up where she lived. And finally, I read a small article that suggested that those people who have long COVID symptoms, if they got the vaccine, they would probably get fairly severe side effects from it. Nothing life-threatening, but more than the average person. But that 40% of them would improve or completely go away. And so she got vaccinated, one, because she didn't want to get it a third time and knew it was out there, and two, because she wanted some chance of getting rid of her symptoms. And in fact, after having symptoms from the vaccine that lasted a week or two, 3 weeks later, all of her symptoms of long COVID went away, everything. And honestly, we're all grateful for that. She's kind of like the poster child for vaccination for long COVID.
As you mentioned earlier, COVID has come to rural Iowa and rural areas of the country, and in some places in a really, really heartbreaking way. Tell me about the losses that you're seeing in Lucas County from COVID.
You know, those have changed a bit. We don't see as many deaths now, but they're not the same. Early on in this pandemic, most of those deaths, not all, but most of those deaths were people in their 60s or above. And we now know that the average age in hospitalization is 41. And we haven't had a lot of deaths, but we have had a pregnant woman who had an emergency C-section to cut the baby out, and the baby lived, but she died. And to me, that's it's tragic. It's sad. It's preventable. This didn't have to happen. The chances are so much better that had this person been vaccinated, they might have still gotten COVID, but the chances are very good she wouldn't have ended up in the hospital, and she certainly wouldn't have died and left a child that's orphaned now, that will not have a mother. And to me, I as a physician, it's awful. It's an awful feeling that you can't help some of these people, and that such awful things were preventable but still can't be stopped.
I mentioned earlier that we are seeing this wave of people who wind up in COVID, you know, in a COVID ward in the hospital and are dangerously ill, making these videos, sending out messages saying, I wish that I'd gotten vaccinated. I wish that I had known. And it starts to feel, I mean, it's really demoralizing in so many ways, but it starts to feel like people aren't going to believe it until it happens to them. I also feel like a lot of people aren't sharing their COVID experiences because there's some kind of stigma or shame attached to getting this virus that so many people don't believe is real. Do you find that people who have COVID in Lucas County are not telling others about it?
I find a mix of things there. There are the ones who get COVID who don't want to acknowledge it. Their symptoms aren't that severe. They know they were exposed. They know they have symptoms. They don't want to miss work, and they continue going to work. There are others who get COVID and don't want to say anything because their church will shun them. I've had people who've been vaccinated because their jobs required it and then were shunned by their church. And I just don't understand that. It has become a dividing point for things that people shouldn't have to. They shouldn't have to be afraid that the people they're closest to or the people of faith that they depend on will treat them differently because of a disease.
That's so interesting that a church would shun someone on the basis of vaccination, because there are very few organized religions that reject vaccination as a practice. This is so different.
I don't understand it, because almost certainly all of those people had their childhood vaccinations. Many of them probably had flu vaccine, but somehow this vaccine has been looked at and treated differently in the minds of so many, and even of people of faith. And I don't understand why they would step in and say, no, this is wrong, this is against God or whatever. I've had people who tried to tell me it's not really a vaccine. I've had people who tried to tell me all kinds of things about the vaccine that I know can't possibly be. And some of this is being promulgated by churches. I've had people who told me, no, I'm not going to do that because it will change my DNA and I won't be conservative anymore. I've had people say it's all a government conspiracy to control our population and make women sterile. And it all seems to come back to misinformation and brainwashing that comes at people from so many directions that then they don't know who to trust. They don't know who to believe. And so they believe what they want to believe.
You sound so tired, frustrated, and fatigued just in this moment. When you think about the future, what are you worried about with this incredible lack of trust that we're seeing right now? Do you feel like this changes things beyond COVID-19, if we ever get beyond it?
I think it's obvious that it changes that. It's because it has changed the doctor-patient relationship. That there's so much trust necessary for people to put their lives in my hands, for people to trust that I'm going to give them the information that is in their best interests. And when you introduce doubt into that, what happens when they get other serious diseases? Do they pause? Do they try to say, you know, maybe it just isn't so. They weren't true about this or that. And so they may be late in getting help for things that were also preventable, fixable, treatable, whatever. And so it's obvious to me that this changes a great deal in our healthcare system, as well as the doctor-patient relationship. I look around me and I see doctors and nurses who are leaving because they're done, because they don't feel that they can do anymore what they needed to do for people, or they feel that they've been betrayed by our country, or they feel that they've been forced into things and in some ways sacrificed by our country to do things that they shouldn't have had to do for so long.
Do you feel like giving up?
No, I'm not one of those people. I'm a survivor in that respect. I'm fortunate in that I don't feel burnout in the same way. I feel the need to go out and talk. I feel the need to communicate to other people the best I can. And I don't give up. I have seen other things in my life that are more than a little challenging. And those things have helped me to overcome these kinds of challenges. I lost my first wife to breast cancer 15 years ago after a 6-year battle.
Oh, and I'm so sorry. And Dr. Cohen, though, we are out of time, but thank you so much for sharing your experiences with us today.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for letting me.
Dr. Greg Cohen of Lucas County, Iowa. This is Talk of Iowa.